Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, April 28th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us today. Today's weather, plentiful sunshine, highs to 81 degrees Fahrenheit, winds northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, a clear sky, lows to 53 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts plentiful sunshine, highs to 82 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star's front page titled, Airstrikes Push Palestinian Death Toll Past 52,000. This article was written by Wafa Sharafa and Sammy Magdi of the Associated Press, Dateline Deir al-Balah Gaza Strip. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip received the remains of 51 Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes in the past 24 hours. The local health ministry said on Sunday, bringing the Palestinian death toll from the 18-month-old Israeli-Hamas war to 52,243. Israel ended its ceasefire with Hamas by launching a surprise bombardment on March 18th and has carried out daily waves of strikes. Ground forces expanded a buffer zone and encircled the southern city of Rafah and now control around 50% of the territory. Israel has also sealed off to Gaza's 2 million Palestinians from all imports, including food and medicine, for nearly 60 days. Aid groups say supplies will soon run out and that thousands of children are malnourished. The overall death toll includes nearly 700 bodies for which the documentation process was recently completed, the ministry said in its latest update. The daily toll includes bodies received, or rather retrieved, from the rubble after earlier strikes. Israeli strikes killed another 23 people in the ministry's update. 8 of them, including 3 children and 2 women, were killed in a strike in a tent in the southern city of Khan Yunis, according to Nasser Hospital. A strike in the central city of Deir al-Balah killed 4 people, according to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, and another on a tent that were killed 4 children and a man, the hospital said. A strike hit a coffee shop near the entrance on the Bereav refugee camp in central Gaza, killing at least 6 people, according to Al-Awda and Al-Aqsa Hospitals. My son, why did you go out, my son? One man, Ayed Omar, said in Deir al-Balah as he mourned. Israeli authorities say the renewed offensive and tightened blockade are aimed at pressuring Hamas to release hostages abducted in its attack October 7, 2023. That triggered the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to continue the war until Hamas is destroyed or disarmed and all the hostages are returned. Hamas has said it will only release the remaining 59 hostages, 24 believed to be alive, in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, a lasting ceasefire, and a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, as called for in the now-defunct ceasefire reached in January. Hamas-led militants killed around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, in the October 7th attack, and took 251 people hostage. Most have since been released in the ceasefire agreements or other deals. Gaza's health ministry says women and children make up most of the Palestinians' deaths, but doesn't say how many were militants or civilians. It says another 117,600 people have been wounded in the war. The overall tally includes the 2,151 dead and the 5,598 wounded since Israel resumed the war last month. Israel says it has killed around 20,000 militants without providing evidence. The military tries to avoid harming civilians and it blames Hamas for their deaths because the militants operate in densely populated areas. Israel's offensive has destroyed vast parts of Gaza and displaced around 90% of its population, leaving hundreds of thousands of people sheltering in squalid tent camps or bombed-out buildings. Also on Sunday, Israeli jets struck Beirut's southern suburbs after issuing a warning about an earlier attack, marking the 3rd Israeli strike on the area since a ceasefire took effect in late November. In a statement following the strike, the Israeli military said it targeted a precision-guided missile storage facility for the militant Hezbollah group. It added that storing such equipment is a violation of the agreement reached to end the Israeli-Hezbollah war. A huge plume of smoke billowed over the area after the strike, which hit what looked like a metal tent situated between two buildings with three bombs, according to an Associated Press photographer on the ground and footage circulating on social media. The photographer saw that two burnt and destroyed trucks inside the hangar. There were no immediate reports of casualties. In a warning, the Israeli military said it was targeting Hezbollah facilities in the Hadath area and urged citizens, or rather residents, to move at least 300 yards from the site before the strike. Two warning strikes followed. Fighter jets were heard over parts of the Lebanese capital before the strike near the Al-Jamuz neighborhood, where gunfire was shot into the air to warn residents and urge them to evacuate as families fled in panic. During the last Israel-Hezbollah war, Israeli drones and fighter jets regularly pounded the southern suburbs where Hezbollah has wide influence and support. Israel views the area where it has assassinated several of Hezbollah's top leaders, including Chief Hassan Nasrallah, as a militant stronghold and accuses the group of storing weapons there. President Joseph Aoun condemned the Israeli strike on Beirut's southern suburbs, calling the United States and France as guarantors of the ceasefire to assume their responsibilities and pressure Israel to halt its attack. He warned that Israel's continuing actions undermine stability and risk exposing the region to serious security threats. UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, Janine Hennis, posted on X that the latest Israeli strike generated a panic and fear of renewed violence among these desperate for a return to normalcy. She urged all sides to halt any actions that could further undermine the ceasefire and understanding and the implementation of the UN resolution that ended the war. Title of the next front page article is titled, Bill Put Private School Kids on Public School Sports Teams. This article was written by Bob Christie of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Republicans who have championed school choice programs, including voucher programs that allow state money to fund private school tuition, now want to require Arizona's public school districts to let private school students compete on their sports teams. But the legislation raises a series of concerns, not the least of which is whether they would dispute students already attending those public schools from team rosters. The measure was championed by Senator John Kavanaugh, Republicans of Fountain Hills, comes as some districts are letting private school students join their local high school teams, but others, including his home district, are not. Kavanaugh argues that private school students should have the same opportunities to participate in interscholastic sports and other activities like clubs as students attending their local public school if their private school doesn't offer those activities. Extracurricular school activities, be it football or the chess club, they're an important part of the students' learning activities and also an important part of their mental health, Kavanaugh told a House committee last month. The measure was approved on a voice vote by the House last week and awaits a formal vote. It has already passed the Senate. Kavanaugh noted he sponsored a law several years ago that lets homeschooled students try out for public school teams. He said private school students should also have the opportunity. He said his bill, SB 1693, has protections to prevent parents from gaming the system, including rules saying they must live within the boundaries of private school where they want their children to play. Their child has to have passing grades and that the private school they attend doesn't offer the sport or activity. They also need to pay any fees that all players must pay and a prorated share of the program costs. Democrats and associations representing school districts and high school sports are strongly opposed, arguing that private school students could take sports and on a team and displace children attending the public school. You guys can change a number of laws down here, but you can't change the rules related to a certain sport, Mark Barnes, a lobbyist for the Arizona School Administrators Association, told the House Education Committee during a recent hearing. Soccer, there's 11 people on the field, basketball, 5 people on the court, baseball, each team gets 9 people, he said. So there's a capacity in all these programs, so you can't just open up teams to an infinite amount of people. Barry Ahrens, a lobbyist for the Arizona Interscholastic Association and the Arizona Association of School Superintendents, echoed these worries and ticked off several others. First, let me tell you that choice is choice, Ahrens told the House panel. He noted that parents choose where their child goes to school for a variety of reasons, and sometimes the school they choose doesn't have a particular sport. That's a trade-off that parents accepted, Ahrens argued, and forcing a local school they don't intend to let them play on teams and keep a student at that school from participating just isn't fair. Fountain Hills District has chosen not to allow this, he says, referring to Kavanaugh's community. That's their choice as a school board, Ahrens said. Mesa Public Schools has chosen to allow it. That's their choice. Ahrens also pointed to the growing number of microschools created for the purpose of athletic participation. He said those schools could put together a roster of top-notch players and then get them all to try out for a certain school's team, overwhelming Curtin players. Kavanaugh argued that parents pay property taxes to their local school districts and should be allowed the benefits. The parents pay the same amount of taxes for it. I don't know why you would want to exclude kids, Kavanaugh said during a Senate hearing on the bill. Barnes dismissed the tax argument. He noted that people pay taxes to fund the corrections department, community school districts, and many other government functions, even if they don't use those services. Just because somebody pays taxes, I don't think that alone qualifies them to allow their child to go to participate in a school district school sport when they have chosen another school, Barnes said. We're not expecting the private schools that take a school voucher to open up a sport that they may have that a district doesn't offer. That references to the fact that Arizona offers vouchers of taxpayers' money, dollars that parents can use to pay tuition and expenses at private and parochial schools. Originally intended to help students with special needs, it now is available to all students regardless of disabilities or parental income, with the voucher starting at $7,500 a year. The cost to taxpayers now exceeds $800 million. Governor Katie Hobbs has proposed scaling back eligibility based on parental income, but that has proven to be a non-starter among Republicans. That still leaves the question of whether students who are going to private schools should be participating in interscholastic sports at public schools. Senator Catherine Miranda, Democrat of Levine, asked Kavanaugh whether he was concerned that a private school student would not fit in with public school students who know each other and are already bonded. Kavanaugh dismissed the concerns. During the House debate this week, Representative Nancy Gutierrez, Democrat of Tucson, pointed out what she said were built-in inequities in Kavanaugh's bill that are unfair to children attending a public school. She noted that all it requires to show private school students are passing their classes is a note from their parent, not the formal review of grades that students enrolled at a public school need. And she said there's nothing preventing private schools from joining the Arizona Interscholastic Association and fielding their own sports teams to compete across the state. Some already do. Profi College Preparatory, a Jesuit school in Phoenix for boys, is an AIA member. So are South Point Catholic High School and Push Ridge Christian Academy, both in Tucson and Gilbert Christian School. When we're talking about parent choice and school choice, if you choose a school that does not have a sport, then that's the school you choose, Gutierrez says. So if sports is the most important thing to a student, they should choose a school that has vibrant sports activity. She continued, this is not have your cake and eat it too. This is you choose and then you get what you get, and you don't throw a fit. Representative Matt Gress, Republican of Phoenix, pushed back, noting that many parents choose a private school because their child has a reading deficit like dyslexia that their local school isn't able to address. I believe that this is far more of a complicated issue than opponents would let on, he said. So when I hear my colleagues say, you get what you get, sorry, if you have a learning disability, no sports for you, you can't engage in these interscholastic activities. I think that's downright disappointing, Gress said. We should be helping all kids in the state of Arizona, regardless of where they come from, regardless of the school environment that they are in. We want every kid to thrive. That's what this is about. The title of the next front page article is Canadians Booking Far Fewer U.S. Visits. This article was written by Bob Gillies and Jim Morris of the Associated Press, Dateline Vancouver, British Columbia. Diana and Rick Bellamy initially planned to take a Caribbean cruise out of Houston before heading to Laurel, Mississippi, to visit the home of one of their favorite HGTV shows, Hometown. Calgary couple scrapped those plans and vacationed last month along Mexico's Pacific coast instead, put off by U.S. President Donald Trump's trade war with Canada, the insults he's hurled at their homeland, and stories about American border agents searching people's phones and detaining foreigners for minor reasons. She found it ironic that she felt more comfortable in traveling to Mexico than the U.S. "I never thought I would hear myself say that," Diane Bellamy said. Trump attacks on Canada's economy and threats to make it the 51st state have infuriated Canadians who are canceling trips to the U.S. in big numbers. They also seem to have also flipped the narrative heading into Canada's parliamentary elections on Monday, with Prime Minister Mark Carney's Liberal Party surging after trailing far behind in the polls just a few months ago. The U.S. gets more visitors from Canada each year than from any other country, according to the U.S. Travel Association, an industry trade group, which said the 20.4 million visits from Canada last year generated $20.5 billion in spending. But there has been a big drop in foreigners traveling to the U.S. since Trump took office, and Canadians are no exception. There were more than 910,000 fewer land border crossings from Canada into the U.S. last month than in March 2024, a more than 22% drop, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection data. An Air Canada spokesman, meanwhile, said Canada-U.S. flight bookings for April through September are down about 10%. Trump brushed aside the decline in tourism to the United States on Wednesday, saying, "There's a little nationalism there, I guess, perhaps. It's not a big deal." Since Trump started his second term, there have been well-publicized reports of tourists being stopped at U.S. border crossings and held for weeks at immigration detention facilities before being allowed to fly home at their own expense. On March 3rd, Canadian Jasmine Mooney, an actor and entrepreneur in a U.S. work visit, was detained by U.S. border agents in San Diego. She was released after 12 days of detention. But Mooney's release, British Columbia Premier David Eby expressed concern, saying, "It certainly reinforces anxiety that many Canadians have about our relationship with the U.S. right now, and the unpredictability of this administration and its actions." The Canadian Association of University Teachers, which represents faculty and staff at Canadian universities, warned its members against non-essential travel to the U.S. due to the political landscape under Trump and reports of Canadians encountering difficulties across the border. Academics who have expressed negative views about the Trump administration should be particularly cautious about traveling to the U.S., said the group. "People are scared to cross the border. I don't know what Americans are thinking, quite frankly. Are they that oblivious?" said former Quebec Premier Jean Charest, who has family in Florida. Mike Sauer, who runs a community policing center in Vancouver, said he and his partner have no interest in traveling to the U.S. now because of Trump's politics and border fears. One of Sauer's concerns is that if a border guard were to check his cell phone, the guard might see his past purchases of marijuana, which is legal to buy in Canada and about half the 50 states, but is illegal under U.S. federal law. "The states have different views on drugs. They could certainly look at my phone and see I'm 420 friendly," he said, meaning he's marijuana friendly. "I think it kind of depends on which border guard would have a problem with that and which ones wouldn't." Deidre Wilson, 32, when she was younger, said she often visited Detroit, which is just across the border from Windsor, Ontario, where she and her husband Ben own a second-hand shop. She hasn't visited much in recent years, though, and she said she heard of people's worries about crossing the border since Trump moved back into the White House. "It's worrisome," she said. Ben Wilson, 37, also has qualms about trying to cross. "Why would I want to?" he said. "Regardless of the traffic, I mean the tariffs, if I'm going to be stopped at the border for my phone or something somebody texted me, why go?" The drop in Canadian tourism to the U.S. led California Governor Gavin Newsom, a frequent target of Trump, to announce an ad campaign this month meant to lure Canadians back to his state, citing a 12% year-on-year drop in February. Mackenzie McMillan, a consultant with Vancouver-based travel agency The Travel Group, said, "The company's bookings to the U.S. have dried up. We have seen a near-total collapse of U.S. business," he said, "probably about a 90% drop since February." Leslie Keiter, the CEO and founder of Travel Lady Agency in Calgary, said she's seen people actually forfeit money to cancel their U.S. trip. Even if they're going to a Caribbean cruise, they don't want to go down to Fort Lauderdale to get on the cruise ship, she said. The next front page article is titled Trump Backs Faster Permitting, but not for solar or wind projects. This article was written by Jennifer McDermott of the Associated Press. For years, proponents of green energy argued that a slow, inefficient permitting process in the United States hindered a transition to clean sources of electricity. Permitting reform, as it's called, is needed to unleash green energies like solar and wind, which don't emit greenhouse gases that cause climate change, supporters argued. The Trump administration agrees on the need to speed up energy projects, but not for wind or for solar, which is the fastest-growing source of electricity generation in the U.S. The Interior Department said this past week that it's opting an alternative process for energy projects to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, shortening the reviews to about 28 days and 14 days, respectively. It typically takes about 2 years for the federal government to approve a full environmental impact statement or up to 1 year to complete an environmental assessment. The 1970 environmental law, is known as NEPA, is designed to ensure community safeguards during review for a wide range of federal proposals, including roads, bridges, and energy projects. The procedures apply to energy sources including oil and natural gas, petroleum, uranium, coal, biofuels, and critical minerals. They'll also apply to geothermal and hydropower, both which generate electricity without emitting planet-warming greenhouse gases. President Donald Trump declared a national energy emergency on his first day in office to speed up fossil fuel development. Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum said the department is cutting through unnecessary delays to fast-track resources that are essential to the nation's economy, military readiness, and global competitiveness. The cumbersome process helps enable China to dominate in processing and critical refining minerals, said Rich Nolan, president and chief executive officer of the National Mining Association. Streamlining it will make U.S. more competitive, he added. Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon said the administration is using a fake energy emergency to strip away essential legal safeguards. It's a blatantly illegal move, and we will see them in court, she said in a statement. The Sierra Club said it's concerned the new approach effectively reduces environmental review and public input to a formality. These arbitrary time limits make a complete review of the risks but of potentially hazardous projects impossible, Ethan Manuel, director of the Sierra Club's Land Protection Program, said in a statement on Thursday. A shoddy review means the true hazards of a project may only be known when the air or water thousands of people rely on it's dangerously polluted. Randy Spivak at the Center for Biological Diversity said the Interior's plan proves that Trump's fabricated energy emergency is a hoax designed to ramp up through fracking and coal mining. Spivak, the center's public lands policy director, said it's a lose-lose deal for everyone other than the fossil fuel executives who support Trump. During the Biden administration, the Interior Department tried to move fast on energy projects, but did so within the fairly comfortable confines of existing permitting processes, said Travis Anatonin, who was then the department's deputy solicitor for energy and mineral resources. Burgum, on the other hand, is attempting to change the entire permitting process at a deep, structural level overnight, added Anatoine, now counsel at the law firm Arnold & Porter. By excluding solar and wind, the administration risks undercutting the asserted rationale for the energy emergency. In a real emergency, would you want to be pouring electrons into the grid from any source that you could find, he said. Last week, the Interior Department issued an order to stop construction on a major offshore wind project to power more than 500,000 New York homes. Burgum said he was doing so because it appeared the Biden administration rushed the approval. The Norwegian company Equinor went through a 7-year permitting process before starting to build Empire Wind last year. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The first article is titled, Deported Migrants Struggle to Build Lives on the Edge. This article was written by Laura Sandoval Vidrio of Cronkite News. Dateline Nogales. The morning light beams down harshly through the sparse branches of a few trees growing on the edges of Cancha Reforma a vacant basketball court in Colonia del Rosario, one of the many colonias or neighborhoods of Nogales, Sonora. The benches, once places for gathering and community, now sit abandoned and weathered. The paint is peeling and their first surfaces are cold. A gentle breeze rushes empty chip bags and soda cups across the court's cracked asphalt, creating a faint rustle. This abandoned space has transformed into an unwilling refuge where deported migrants and displaced families from the United States are now forced to call home. In the shadows behind the court, there are fragile structures made of tarp, plywood, scraps of metal, and plastic, providing just enough shelter to survive. We have formed a community here. We now know are not alone in this, said Maria Rosario Lopez, a maid and mother of two who lived in Avondale before she was deported more than a year ago. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcer, or ICE, agents raided her friend's home during the carne asada gathering in search of undocumented immigrants. Despite having a pendulum asylum case for her legal status, the agents detained Lopez and sent her to the Eloy Detention Center in Arizona, where she waited for over 6 months to fight her case to stay in the United States. Lopez is one of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants to the U.S. who are at risk for deportation. Standing alongside her are other deported women, men, and children huddled together. The conditions in the detention facility are so cruel, Lopez said, that she could not withstand the internal pain, living in solitude and confined to a small cell. She chose deportation for the sake of her mental well-being, leaving behind her 13 and 30-year-old sons. I have no other choice, Lopez said. I have to keep moving forward for them. ICE operates more than 190 facilities for detention across the U.S. to hold non-citizens while they go through immigration proceedings or wait to be deported after a final removal order. The deportation process is not only a prolonged procedure, it is also inhumane. According to Lopez, ICE agents were unapologetic, arrogant, and blatantly racist. They treat us like we're some criminals. It's not a detention center, it's a prison. Lopez suffered from a fractured foot while she was in the process of deportation. When offered an opportunity to have surgery, Lopez denied help. She said she didn't feel comfortable with the agents and medical staff and felt she was in danger. Let go of my foot, Lopez told the ICE agents as they tightly cuffed her fractured foot ankle during her deportation. My ankle is in a lot of pain, but they didn't listen to me. They didn't care. Her deportation experience and neglect is not unique. People in detention frequently experience serious delays in accessing mental health services, and many of their requests for care go unanswered, according to a report from the National Immigrant Justice Center. At least 6 people have died in ICE custody during this final year, according to the Detention Watch Network. Each of these deaths represent a preventable tragedy and underscores the systematic danger posed by placing people in immigration detention. ICE has failed to provide adequate, even basic, mental and medical health care and ensure that people in detention are treated with dignity, said ACLU senior staff attorney Eunice Haine Cho in a report published last year. Detention and deportation not only increase fear among immigrant families, but also have serious negative effects on their health and well-being, according to focus group studies by Kaiser Permanente. Lopez said she is still coping with the trauma of her experience in ICE custody. When told the psychologist how bad I was suffering mentally, they refused to listen, Lopez said. They said, you couldn't do anything for me, and that was the last time I looked for help. These people are forgotten, said Alma Mendoza, founder of Esperanza, a nonprofit that helps deport families with food, medical equipment, clothing, toys, and other basic necessities. Esperanza means hope in Spanish. Volunteers from the nonprofit visit Cancha Reforma 3 to 4 times a month, arriving in a minivan loaded with coolers of water for hydration, energy drinks, and tuna to make protein sandwiches for the stranded people. Like so many of us, our everyday necessities seem so significant, but to them it means everything, Mendoza said. Mendoza gathers donations from her day job cleaning houses in Phoenix, used clothes, shoes, socks, backpacks. Her family also helps purchasing items from thrift stores to take to the border. They are immigrants helping to sustain the economy, but they are more than just immigrants, they're human beings too, Mendoza said. In the end, the reality for many deported immigrants and their families is a life defined by fear, limited access to health care, and overwhelming uncertainty. There is no justice system, and Mendoza said. It is a broken system. At Rancha Cancha Reforma, Mendoza carefully passes out food and water in the blazing heat. Children run across the cracked court giggling. Mothers sit on worn benches chatting and watching over them. Even in the middle of displacement, a community endures, and Esperanza or hope is what keeps this community alive. For Lopez, she hopes justice will prevail and dreams about being reunited with her family soon. We'll now pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll continue with the next Tucson and region article from the Arizona Daily Star. This article is titled, Critics, Tucson Prison Killing Avoidable. This article was written by Erica Wurst of the Arizona Daily Star. The State Department of Corrections' decision to move Ricky Wassenaar to a low-security prison in Tucson resulted in three inmates being killed, prison critics say, and they add, it could have been avoided. Wassenaar, serving multiple life terms related to a prison escape attempt years ago in which a corrections officer was raped, was transferred from a maximum custody prison out of state to a lower level of close custody in 2018 at Tucson's Cimarron Unit. It was a lethal move that likely made it easier for Wassenaar to fulfill his ongoing threats to kill, says Carlos Garcia, executive director for the Arizona Correctional's Peace Officers Association, who has worked with the Arizona prison system for 20 years. He said his information about the attacks came from the reports he received. And that's what he did, and he fulfilled it with a vengeance, Garcia said. On April 4th, prison officials and advocates say Wassenaar went to a methodical killing spree, and within minutes, three fellow inmates were dead. Saul Alvarez, who had been in prison since 2004 for first-degree murder in Maricopa County. Thorin Harnage, who had been in prison since 2024 after being sentenced in Pima County for sexual contact with a minor. Donald Lashley, who has been in prison since 2023 after being sentenced in Pima County for sexual contact with a minor and molestation of a child. Donna Hamm has spent more than four decades fighting for prison reform. Through the years, Hamm said, thought she heard it all, until a call in November from Wassenaar, who reached out to the director of Middle Ground Prison Reform with an unusual declaration. He had strangled his new 81-year-old cellmate, Joseph DeStisto, but not before warning prison staff he'd do so if they forced him to have him as a bunkie. Wassenaar told Hamm he strangled DeSisto because he got on his nerves. There should be no doubt about it, Wassenaar said, because his sweat, fingerprints, and other DNA should be all over the man's body. With the admission, Wassenaar could now get what he wanted, a cell to himself. That didn't happen. The department found no proof Wassenaar had killed DeSisto, whose death list is undetermined. Wassenaar refused to accept the determination and called Hamm angry and upset that despite her call to prosecutors, no charges have been filed against him in connection with DeSisto's death. In an email to Hamm, the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation and Reentry Director Ryan Thornell wrote that DeSisto's death had been thoroughly investigated and there were no indications of anything other than a natural death. You have my assurance that there is no cover-up or other wrong behavior occurring, regardless of what Mr. Wassenaar may be sharing with you, Thornell wrote. Thornell wrote that DeSisto passed away from natural causes due to the underlying medical conditions as reported by the medical examiner. His cause of death was listed, however, as undetermined. These few sentences do not quench Hamm's desire to find what she believed was the truth, she said. In a statement released by Thornell, the director made it clear what the department has no reason to believe that inmate Wassenaar had any involvement in DeSisto's demise, despite the threats and Wassenaar being so adamant about now having a cellmate that he used his body to try to block officers from opening the cell to let the Sisto in, Ham said. Less than 6 months later, in March 2024, after telling everyone who would listen that he strangled the Sisto, Wassenaar's custody level was reduced from maximum security based on his good behavior. With nothing to lose and failing to be charged with a homicide he claimed to have committed, Ham said Wassenaar found a new way to kill. In a single attack, Wassenaar is accused of killing a cellmate and two more inmates in the prison yard. The two provided a chilling description of what they said happened on the morning of April 4th. One man was killed in a cell at the Cimarron unit, strangled and stabbed in the eye with a makeshift knife called a shank, according to Garcia. The body was then covered and posed as if he was sleeping on the side on his bunk, Garcia said. The killer then walked from the cell and crossed the prison yard to the dining area, where he instigated a fight, Garcia said. He used a laundry bag stuffed with rocks to smash in one inmate's head and used a shank to slit the throat of a second, Garcia said. Wassenaar was named the sole suspect in the three killings by the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. The agency has provided limited information saying an altercation between inmates took place near the dining area, resulting in the death of two men. Garcia said that the department describing Wassenaar's attack as a series of altercations minimizes the events and elicits images of inmates fighting, he said. Instead, Wassenaar ambushed inmates after he warned several people that he was hell-bent on killing someone. He's not hiding it. He's been warning the department he was going to kill someone, and they left him alone with another new cellmate who he allegedly killed, Garcia said, and put him in the yard with dozens of others where he allegedly killed two additional men. So Garcia and Ham were on the case just trying to confirm how the Sisto died and why Wassenaar was never charged or disciplined in connection with that cellmate's death. They played chicken with the wrong inmate. They rolled dice and it didn't work out for them, Garcia said. The day after the killing of the three inmates, Ham was at her computer feverishly typing a formal letter to Governor Katie Hobbs. Ham explained the November 2024 situation with the Sisto and Wassenaar's allegations of a cover-up regarding his cause of death. She also shared her contact with the prison director. She told Hobbs that in a phone call, Wassenaar all but begged to take claim for killing the Sisto. Thornell had been relayed this message, Ham said, but failed to act. It is incomprehensible why or how Wassenaar would be given access to or contact in a manner with other inmates, she wrote Hobbs. Only utter incompetence or deliberate indifference could explain such a tragic error. She pleaded that these murders be investigated by independently. This tragedy for the three men killed yesterday was likely avoidable, Ham wrote to Thornell, as she reminded him of Wassenaar's admission of the Sisto's death in November. If Ricky Wassenaar had been taken seriously, no one confesses to a murder as frequently and as adamantly as he did, the deaths of these men yesterday could surely have been avoided. I hope the department's prepared for what is now coming your way in a legal sense as a result of the failures to take appropriate action to isolate Mr. Wassenaar after the DeSisto incident. In a public statement, however, Thornell is standing his ground, saying staffing was not an issue during Wassenaar's alleged killing spree and that corrections officers did all they could to de-escalate the situation. Staffing issues have plagued Arizona prisons for years, leaving inmates potentially vulnerable to attacks. The ACLU spotlighted staffing shortages in a 2023 lawsuit against Thornell, according to the Arizona Republic. Correctional officer vacancies at the Tucson prison complex remain high compared with other Arizona prisons in 2025, records show. Nine officers were working in the Cimarron unit during the time of the triple homicide, fewer than half the number needed to fully staff the unit, Garcia said. The unit can accommodate 576 beds. What happened in the Cimarron unit was nothing short of a tragedy. Violence of any kind is not tolerated, Thornell wrote. What occurred was a senseless act by one person who appeared to be solely focused on seeking harm to these specific individuals without any prior warning. Thornell called the murder of three inmates a heinous act and said Wassenaar will be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law. I am proud to be of the quick response by the staff. An ASPC Tucson that morning. Their training kicked in immediately, quickly subduing the situation and ensuring no other inmates were seriously injured, Thronell wrote. This wasn't Wassenaar's first headline case. In 2005, Wassenaar was convicted on 19 charges, including kidnapping, dangerous or deadly assault by a prisoner, aggravated assault, sexual assault, a first-degree escape for his involvement in the 2004 hostage situation in the state prison near Buckeye, the department said. Wassenaar has a lengthy criminal record stemming back to 1986, when he was charged with armed robbery and aggravated assault. 10 years into a 15-year sentence, Wassenaar was placed on house arrest in 1996 when he went on to be convicted of 8 counts of aggravated assault and 1 count of armed robbery in 1997. He was given a 20-year sentence. A 2004 attempted prison escape landed him with 16 life sentences. After 4 years in the Lewis prison complex in Buckeye, Wassenaar attempted to escape with his cellmate Stephen Coy. They plotted to escape from the kitchen to an arsenal tower and through the administration building. The Arizona Republic detailed his and Coy's attempted escape in 2004. Early that morning, the two inmates fled the kitchen, raping, assaulting, and tying up 2 workers while en route to the tower. They made it to the watchtower, but were trapped as more and more officers surrounded it. The pair took 2 correctional officers hostage, one of whom was a mother. Both sexually assaulted her on the first day. The other suffered head injuries, according to the Republic. Negotiations lasted more than 2 weeks. Eventually, Wassenaar surrendered after being promised a transfer to the Midwest. Coy also gave himself up, though hostages survived. Coy was serving a life sentence for 2 counts of armed robbery and aggravated assault at the time of the attempted escape, along with a slew of other sentences for previous offenses. He added 7 more life sentences. Wassenaar added 16 life sentences to his prior 28-year sentence. He was returned to Arizona in 2018. I think this is all about getting his own cell, Garcia said of Wassenaar's most recent alleged attacks. Wassenaar was transferred to a maximum custody housing unit where he remains, Thornell said. In the statement sent to the Arizona Republic on April 14th, the department said commenting on the case would be irresponsible and potentially debilitating to the case. The ADCRR recognizes that person, including those not affiliated with the department, may find it advantageous to make public their theories about what occurred or their opinion about motivations. The ADCRR actions, procedures, or processes, the statement said. Keep in consideration these individuals lack first-hand knowledge of the situation, so their perspectives are merely the opinions of people from outside the situation. The next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, Candidates for City Council Report Finances. This article was written by Charles Bola of the Arizona Daily Star. With the election still months away, candidates for Tucson City Council already are starting to see campaign dollars roll in, campaign finance reports show. The filing reports vary, but generally cover February and in some cases March too. They were due on April 15th. Ward 3. Incumbent Kevin Dahl faces a challenge from fellow Democrat Sadie Shaw, who currently serves on the TUSD governing board. Republican Janet J.L. Widebreaker, the sole Republican running for the seat, lost in the November election for a seat on the Pima County Board of Supervisors. Dahl reported having over $20,700 on hand entering the reporting period and raising about $8,400 through March, with no money coming in from PACs, and spent about $6,350 and entered April with over $22,800 on hand, according to his campaign finance report. Shaw reported entering the reporting period with no on-hand funds but raised $2,367 through March, including $1,000 from the Leadership for Educational Equity PAC, and nearly $765 in candidate loans. She reported spending $1.53 and entering April with about $2,366 on hand. Wittenbreaker's filing reported her campaign had no money on hand and that no money was raised or spent. Ward 5. The seat will be vacant once Richard Fimbus resigns May 1st. The Tucson City Council hopes to fill the seat during its May 6 meeting. Three Democrats are running for the seat. Selena Barayas reporting having nearly $6,000 on hand to begin the reporting period and raising about $9,340 through March, including $1,000 from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 99, based in Phoenix, the filing shows. Barajas reported spending about $6,012 and entering April with over $9,300 on hand. Christopher Elsner reported entering the period with $1,080 on hand and raising nearly $2,600 through March, including about $1,000 of which came from family members. Elsner reported spending over $2,100 and entering April with over $1,500 on hand. Jesse Lugo reported entering the period with over $1,500 on hand and raising $16,510, $1,000 of which came from candidate loans. He spent nearly $2,000 through the March reporting period and entered April with over $16,000 on hand. Four Democrats and one Republican will be running for the seat. Karen Ulrich was appointed to the seat in May last year after Steve Kozacek resigned from the post, but Ulrich is not running for election this November. Teresa Reel reported entering February with about $450 on hand and raising an additional $2,110 through March, $500 of which came from her brother Reel, a reported spending $22.61, and entering April with over $2,500 on hand. Leighton Rockefeller Jr. reported nearly $7,600 on hand February 23rd, and raised an additional $17,750 through March. He reported spending over $9,700 through March and entering April with over $15,500 on hand. Miranda Schubert reported having about $8,370 on hand February 23rd, and raising about $5,786 through March. An additional $16,459 was received in public matching funds. Schubert reported spending over $8,150 through March and entering April with over $22,450 on hand. James Sinex reported starting the reporting period with no cash on hand and spending $282.27 of his own money. Jay Tulkoff, the sole Republican running for the Midtown Ward, reported entering the period with $100, raising none and spending none. Voters have to be registered by July 7th for the August 5 primary election. The early voting begins July 9th. The registration deadline for the November 4th general election is October 6th. Early voting begins October 8th. The next article is titled, Arizona Auditor Countersues Over $38 Million Embezzlement. This article was written by Sarah Lapidus of the Arizona Republic. Arizona and its chief auditor hit back at Santa Cruz County in a legal filing accusing officials of negligence and other wrongdoing after a former county official embezzled roughly $38 million in public funds over a decade-long span. The lawsuit comes in response to legal action brought by the county against Arizona Auditor General Lindsay Perry and the state in November 2024. The county's lawsuit claims Perry's office was grossly negligent, which it said emboldened former county treasurer Elizabeth Gutfahr. "We're disappointed but not surprised by the filing of this countercomplaint," said Santa Cruz County Supervisor Rudy Molera, who is named in the lawsuit, in a statement posted on the county's website. "Rather than addressing the serious concerns raised in our original filing, the Auditor General has chosen to deflect attention through retaliatory tactics." Two other current supervisors issued statements as well. The lawsuit alleges several former and current county officials were unjustly enriched by Gutfahr's embezzlement, which was discovered in April 2024. Gutfahr pleaded guilty in November to embezzling $38.7 million from 2014-24, money laundering and tax evasion for failing to pay income tax of more than $13 million. She was waiting sentencing, which is now slated for June 18th. The lawsuit also alleges current and former Santa Cruz County board members and other county employees who were negligent and failed to review reports and supervise Gutfahr, among other issues. Rita Sato, a Maricopa County resident contracted to complete financial statement for Santa Cruz County was negligent for failing to detect Gutfahr's fraudulent reports and documents, according to the lawsuit. The suit, filed in Maricopa County on April 3rd and served to the County Board of Supervisors on April 15th, also includes dozens of unknown people and businesses who played a part in Gutfahr's embezzlement. The 59-page lawsuit contends the county was responsible for detecting fraud and points to various failures by its officials. Now's the time to flip the pages to the Nation and the World section of the Arizona Daily Star to check out several important news articles there. The first article is titled, Russia Launches Attack. This article was written by Vladimir Yurchik and Elise Morton of the Associated Press. Dateline, Kiev, Ukraine. Russia launched a sweeping drone assault and airstrikes across Ukraine early Sunday, killing at least four people, officials said, after U.S. President Donald Trump cast doubt over Russian President Vladimir Putin's willingness to end the war. Three people died and four were wounded in airstrikes on Kostanieta on the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine, the regional prosecutor's office said. Another person died and a 14-year-old girl was wounded in the drone attack on the city of Pavlograd in the Dnipropetrovsk region, which was hit for the third consecutive night, Governor Lysak said. The attacks came hours after Russia claimed to have regained control over the remaining parts of the Kursk region that Ukrainian forces seized in a surprise incursion in August 24. Ukrainian officials said the fighting in Kursk was still ongoing. Trump said Saturday he doubts Putin wants to end the more than three-year-old war, expressing new skepticism a peace deal can be reached soon. Only a day earlier, Trump had said Ukraine and Russia were very close to a deal. There was no reason for Putin to be shooting missiles into civilian areas, cities, and towns over the last few days, Trump wrote in a social media post as he flew back to the U.S. after attending the funeral of Pope Francis at the Vatican, where he met briefly with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Trump also hinted at further sanctions against Russia. On Sunday evening, as he left his golf club in New Jersey, Trump told reporters he remained disappointed in Russia's attacks. Trump said of Putin, "I want him to stop shooting, sit down, and make a deal." Asked what he would do if Russia does not stop its attack, Trump replied, "I have lots of things I can do." U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Sunday the coming week would be very critical and that the U.S. would need to make a determination about whether this is an endeavor that we want to continue to be involved in. Asked on NBC's Meet the Press about possible concessions to Russia, Rubio emphasized the need to be grown-ups and realistic. There is no military solution to this war. The only solution to this war is a negotiated settlement where both sides are going to have to give up something they claim to want and are going to have to give the other side something they wish they didn't, he said. Russia fired 149 exploding drones and decoys in the latest wave of attacks. The Ukrainian Air Force said, adding that 57 were intercepted and another 67 jammed. One person was wounded in drone attacks in the Odessa region and one other was hurt in the city of Zhytomyr. Four people were also wounded in the Russian airstrike Sunday on the city of Kherson, officials said. Russia's defense ministry said air defenses shot down five Ukrainian drones on the border region of Bryansk. The next article from the Nation of the World is titled Darkest Day in Vancouver's History. This article was written by Jim Morris and Rob Gillis. Date of the Associated Press, Dateline Vancouver, British Columbia. Vancouver police ruled out terrorism in a car ramming attack that killed 11 people between the ages of 5 and 65 at a Filipino Heritage Festival in the Canadian city, saying the suspect has a history of mental illness. Dozens of others were injured, some critically, as the tragedy shook the country before a federal election. Some of the injured were not immediately identified. A man driving a black Audi SUV entered the street just after 8 p.m. Saturday and struck people attending the Lapu Lapu Day festival. The Vancouver man was arrested. It is the darkest day in Vancouver's history, Police Chief Steve Ray told a news conference. The person we have in custody does have significant history of interactions with the police and healthcare professionals related to mental health, he said. Video of the aftermath shows the dead and injured along a narrow street in South Vancouver lined by food trucks. The front of the driver's SUV is smashed in. Chris Pangilinan, who brought his pop-up clothing and lifestyle booth to the festival, saw the vehicle enter past the barricade slowly before the driver on the gas in the area that was packed with people after a concert. He said hearing the sounds of bodies hitting the vehicle will never leave his mind. He sideswiped someone on his right side and I was like, oh, yo, yo, and he slammed on the gas again, he said, on the sound of the acceleration, which sounded like an F1 car to start a race. He slammed on the gas, barreled through the crowd, and all I can remember is seeing bodies flying up in the air, higher than the food trucks themselves and landing on the ground, and people yelling and screaming. The 30-year-old Vancouver man was arrested on the scene. Rice said the man was arrested after initially being apprehended by bystanders. Video circulating on social media shows a young man in a black hoodie on his back against a chain-link fence alongside a security guard and surrounded by bystanders. I'm sorry, the man said, holding his hand to his head. Prime Minister Mark Carney canceled two major rallies on the final day of the election campaign before Monday's vote. Last night, families lost a sister, a brother, a mother, a father, son, or daughter. Those families are living every family's nightmare, Carney said. And to them and to the many others who were injured, to the Filipino-Canadian community, and to everyone in Vancouver, I would like to offer my deepest condolences. James Cruzad, a Vancouver business owner, was at the celebration and heard a car rev its engine and then a loud noise, like a loud bang, that he initially thought might be a gunshot. We saw people on the road crying. Others were like running, shouting, or even screaming, asking for help. So we tried to go there just to check what was really actually happening until we found some bodies on the ground. Others were lifeless, others like, you know, injured, Cruzat said. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, April 28th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.